Sounds good. All right, 1965. So many important milestones in our country's history. Civil rights movement was at its peak. Martin Luther King marched in Selma, Alabama. President Lyndon B. Johnson sent the first combat troops to Vietnam. And protests raged everywhere, including here in New Jersey. On a lighter note, the Beatles were at the height of their fame. The Supremes had 4 number one hits. But Woolly Bully was named Billboard's number one song of the year. Today's guest graduated from law school in 1965. 3 years later, after completing his full-time military service, he began practicing law here in South Jersey, and he has not stopped since. I'd like to introduce our very special guest today, Colonel Stephen Patrick.
You know everything, don't you?
Welcome. Thank you very much for joining us here today.
No problem.
So we had a few technical difficulties, but we were persistent, and I'm really happy that we were, because I have not interviewed anyone on New Jersey Criminal Podcast in quite some time, and I had a number of people suggest that I invite you on to be a guest to talk about the practice of law and how it has changed in the last, 58 years since you've been practicing.
Yep.
So let's jump right in. Where were you born? I don't know where you were. I've known you for a really long time.
Orange, New Jersey.
Okay, Orange, New Jersey. And
Essex County.
And did you, I know you went to Rutgers Law.
Right. Rutgers undergraduate, New Brunswick, Rutgers Law in Newark.
And I remember one day when I was a prosecutor down in Cape May County, you brought your law school yearbook in.
Actually, the year before. It was a 64 yearbook. Can't find mine. Buried somewhere.
And you had a pretty special professor at the school at that time.
Right. Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Right. Now,
she was young. She was very attractive, I might add. She just sort of aged and treated her very kindly.
Did you have her as a professor?
No. Okay. No, I didn't. We had 2 women who were professors, and I had neither of them.
So out of all of the professors at Rutgers Law School, when you attended, there was only 2 professors?
2 females.
Yeah, that were females. Do you remember, were there any females in your class? Any women in your class?
I believe there were a couple. That was one of the things that you talk about changes. Women in the law. I mean, when I started out, it was a rare woman. First place I worked was Atlantic City. And I only knew of one woman, Grace Skull. And she did, I believe, mostly estate work. Never saw any women in the actual trial end of it. That's changed.
What made you go to law school? Yeah, what made you go to law school?
Oh, I don't know. I've wanted to be a lawyer. I know I thought the thought was in my mind when I was in high school. In fact, I'm not a good speller sometimes. So we had to write down in homeroom, some sort of what we wanted to be when we grew up. And so I raised my hand and said, how do you spell criminal? I want to be a criminal lawyer. But it brought down the house.
So you went to law school right after high school?
No, I went to law school after college. I went to graduate from Columbia High School.
You went straight through, though, right?
Oh, yeah.
Where did you go to undergrad?
Rutgers, New Brunswick.
And then you went to Rutgers for law school. Okay.
New York, yeah. We were living in East Orange at that time. I moved a lot when I was young. Started out in Orange, hospital, lived in West Orange for about 4 years, a little less than 4 years. And then the war started. My father went into the service. And we moved to Hamden, Connecticut. And the next thing I know, we're back in South Orange renting an apartment. I know we were there on DJ Day because I still remember the bells ringing and my mother crying. Because my father at that time was in the Philippines waiting for the invasion of Japan. So obviously he was going to come home. So it was a good deal. And then we got transferred. No, we moved in with my grandmother, my father's mother, after my grandfather died. Lived there for a couple of years. And then Prudential, where my father worked, transferred us to California. So I went to Van Nuys, California. I was in second grades. And when I moved into seventh grade, they moved me from one junior high to another junior high. And California has a strange situation. They run semesters. They have an A and a B, 7A, 7B. You can start either, depending upon where you come into it. So you can effectively graduate in the dead of winter, such as it is in California. And then the crew moved us back to New Jersey, and we lived in Maplewood. That's where I was when I went to college. And then when my brother went to college, we moved to an apartment in East Orange. So I've been in all the Oranges. And so that's how I ended up wherever I was. And so when I went into the service, got a job in South Jersey, and I made up my mind that my kids weren't going to be shuffled around. I want to say 2 second grade and 3 seventh grades, which meant a lot in terms of making friends and all that kind of silliness.
When did you join the service?
September 19, 1965. In fact, it was an interesting situation. I was at Fort Knox at the Armor School when I should have been sworn in. So I finagled a deal that I was personally sworn in December when I came home on leave. But Chief Justice himself, he came out and swore me in.
December 22nd, 1965, according to NJ Courts.
No, that could be right.
So you graduated from law school in 65, joined the service in September, and then it's not quite.
I was commissioned in 1962, and I had a 3-year obligation or 2-year obligation in ROTC as a reserve officer. So I got a deferment for law school, and then I went. And so I've been in the military since 1962.
And what did you join the Army? I know you're in the National Guard now.
Okay. Rutgers had 2 ROTC programs, Air Force and Army. Because it was a land-grant college, they thought, or all land-grant colleges did, that they had to have 2 years mandatory ROTC. So, and then they've later changed it so it's voluntary all the way through. There's no mandatory anything. And so at the end of those 2 years, I looked around the world, and we still had the draft, and I said, I'd rather be the guy who says, hey, you, than the guy who says, who, me? So I got my commission.
When you...
stationed at Fort Knox for... however long it took me to get through that, and in 66, I got to fly to Germany, where I served for the balance of the 3 years.
So you basically, as soon as you were sworn in as an attorney, you went to Germany and spent 3 years there. Were you married at that time?
Yes, indeed.
And what year did you? When did you get married?
1965. I mean, it was a good year.
It was a busy year. It was a busy year for you.
My wife and I had a little discussion about, I thought, well, I'll get my service out of the way. And she said, no chance, that's going to happen. So we got married in 65, and it was a strange situation. My original, you know, the Army has what they call MOSs, Military Occupation Specialty. When I went off to, got my orders, it sent me to Fort Knox. It had a MOS of 2019. I don't know what it is now. They've changed the numbers around. Nobody could tell me what 2019 was because all the armor officers were 1203 or 1204. 1203 was armor, 1204 was cavalry. So my duty station was supposed to be Garmisch-Partenkirchen. Now, Garmisch-Partenkirchen, for those who don't know, is a ski resort where they held the 36th Winter Olympics. So I figured, well, I've never skied before. I'm willing to learn. And I could have my wife with me if I went for current travel. So I applied for current travel and extended to 3 years because my obligation was only two, but I extended to 3 years. And they promptly denied my concurrent travel and reassigned me to Baumholder, Germany, which is a troop training area. At that time I was there, it was the largest concentration of American soldiers anywhere in the world, I guess, in Fort Knox, because we had the 2nd Brigade, the 8th Infantry Division, which I was part of. We had the 3rd Cavalry. We had the Division of Artillery there and a whole batch of other miscellaneous units. So it was a very busy place. But because I had, in order to get concurrent travel and bring my wife over, I had to go to the 3rd year, and they stuck it to me. We've got you for 3 years, and oh, and by the way, you can't bring your wife, or we're not going to pay to have your wife transported, and by the way, you're going to Baumholder. And when I told all the people what Baumholder was going to, they all laughed. They were envious of me for Garmisch, but not so happy for Baumholder. And by the way, 2019 is post commander.
You read my mind.
I was first lieutenant at the time, and I'm thinking, well, Garmisch had a very small army school there, and I know one of the things people don't realize is the senior man on post is often, it's usually not the post commander. Where I was stationed in Baumholder, the post commander was a major. We had a brigadier general on post, so. I don't know how they decide who's going to be post commander, but it ended up not being me. It ended up being a tanker all the way.
So what was your specialty throughout those 3 years?
Armor. Tanks. Armor.
Okay. My grandfather was a tank sergeant in World War II.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
It's a dicey business. Some people can't stand tanks. They get claustrophobic. Mm-hmm. Never bothered me. And tell you what, it's an interesting experience. What sold me on tanks was when I was in ROTC, they sent me down in my junior year to Fort Bragg for ROTC summer camp, and they put on what they call a firepower demonstration. And at that time, the 82nd Airborne was at Fort Bragg, and they had a tank battalion assigned to them. It was an independent tank battalion, light tanks. They were. Anyhow, with the firepower demonstration, they brought out they're flying overhead, and they dropped a batch of artillery pieces parachuted, and one of them streamered in, so it didn't land successfully. And then they jumped a stick of paratroopers, and a couple of them, their chutes didn't collapse. And the guy said that's because they were injured. They couldn't get up and collapse their chutes. So I said, that's not much fun. Then they had a guy come out with a flamethrower, and it was a fairly windy day, and he lit up his flamethrower, and his sheet of flame shot straight up in the air in front of him. And I said, I don't think I want to be an infantryman either. And then they brought out a tank platoon. Now, having nothing but infantry, it's all close quarters, relatively speaking. These tanks came out, and they did what they call a neutral steer, which basically one tank, one track goes forward, one track goes backward. It can turn in its own space, doesn't it? It doesn't have to do anything. So they figured five tanks came out, neutral steer, will fire five cannons, and they had targets which they put 55-gallon drums of gasoline in. So five pillars of fire and smoke went up in the air. They did neutral steer left and boogied off. And I said, that's my idea and fun. And that's why I ended up being a tanker.
When you came back, so I guess by the time you came back, it was 68.
Right.
And
right after the New York riots.
And where did you move to when you came back? Because, I mean, you've been in, I know you live in Northfield and your law firm's in Newfield, but where did you land when you first came back?
Well, I mean, I stayed with my parents for a couple of months. By that time, I had a daughter. And, she learned how to walk in their apartment. They had an apartment in East Orange, and that's where we stayed. And then I really strange. My father had a friend who had a friend in Atlantic City who was looking for a lawyer. So he called me up and asked me if I wanted to interview for the job. And I said, sure. So he came down, did my interview, and he offered me a job. And I got thinking, I mean, we just had the riots in Newark, and I could see me. I could have had a job with a pretty prestigious law firm in Newark because one of the partners was a good friend of my father's. And I said, you know, I can see myself standing on the street corner in Newark about 10 o'clock at night and wondering if I'm going to get home. Mm-hmm. So when we came down to South Jersey, aside from wondering what kind of place I came to when the first sign to get off the parkway was Pleasantville, and then I saw signs for Bargain Town, I'm saying, is this a comic book I'm going to? but so we landed in Northfield, and that was January of 66.
68.
January 69, yeah.
Got it. January of 69. Who was the lawyer that offered you your first job?
Daniel DeBrier.
Who was it?
He's a Daniel DeBrier, DeBrier and Wallen. They did, as far as I was concerned, they had an insurance company they represented. So he did a lot of personal injury stuff. I know the general had, he wasn't the Air Force Brigadier General. In fact, he was on the same promotion list that Jimmy Stewart was on. And they held up the promotion of all the named Brigadier Generals because somebody didn't think it's appropriate for an actor to be a Brigadier General. Stewart eventually got his promotion, and so did my boss.
How about that? I suspect
was because of my military connection that he gave me a chance. And his partner was municipal court judge in Absecon, so didn't do any criminal work that we're all working for them because it basically barred me.
Now, you are currently still in the National Guard, and so my question is, you're retired.
I'm retired.
Okay. When you came
retired,
back.
I'm getting a pension and enjoying every minute of it. Thank you.
Good. Congratulations. When you came back, did you stay in the reserves, or how did you, I know you spent a long time in the National Guard, that was a big part of your life. So how did that happen?
When I came back, I thought, well, here I am, I'm armor trained, and I enjoyed playing with the things. So I knew the 50th Armored Division was in New Jersey, and I looked around, and of course the phone book only listed the Atlantic City Artillery Battalion, and I said, I'm not really interested in that. So I went to the reserve place in Northfield and got sort of an indifferent feeling from that. And so I contacted the tank battalion in Vineland, and they had an opening. So in March of, I would say 71, mm-hmm. joined the National Guard.
I found an article in the Bridgeton Evening News from 1977, and it was there was a Memorial Day parade in Bridgeton in 1977, and you were at that point in time, I believe, were either a captain or maybe a major for the third battalion, 102nd National
right.
Guard out of Vineland, and you were they quoted you because you were speaking at the Broad Street Cemetery where the
yep.
parade landed. And I remember those parades that went up and down Broad Street in Bridgeton. I was probably at that parade.
I didn't remember seeing you there.
Yeah, right. So, but you were talking about the importance of the flag and the importance of a strong military. So you had, I guess, been in the National Guard for, 6 or 7 years at that point in time?
Yeah. And it was a very culture shock shift from the Army, active Army, to the National Guard. In the active Army, they were really very strong on officers not associating with enlisted. And the reason for that is, obviously, if you get to know and like these guys, you're not going to send them off to get killed, which is part of the problem of being a military officer.
Mm-hmm.
So you come to the National Guard, and everybody's on a first name basis with the officers and enlisted. It really was a culture shock. I can remember going up to Fort Dix, and it was a typical Fort Dix cold, nasty day. And one of the guys comes up to me and says, "Are you cold?" I was, at that point, I was still a captain. And so I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Here." And he holds out a bottle of brandy. I said, "I can do that here on active duty? What did I know? National Guard, they don't have the same rule, or didn't have the same rule. They've tightened it up a lot." Because I can remember we had a guy who was captain. He'd been a captain forever when I was on active duty, and they court-martialed him because he was drunk in the field. And he was just a controller of an exercise. So, I mean, he actually didn't put anyone in danger for that. But the point is, that's how seriously they took drinking on active duty. Whereas in the National Guard, the rule of thumb at that time was when they're done with the training for the day, out come the bonfires and the beer, and it's a whole other world.
Mm-hmm. When did you retire from the National Guard?
69, I think, yeah. I mean, 89.
Okay.
Yeah, because it's a long, convoluted story, but to be the head of the National Guard in New Jersey, you have to be at least a colonel. You have to have had 10 prior years service in the National Guard. They apparently put that through in order to prevent some reservists from being made the adjutant general of the state of New Jersey. Well, that was the year when Jim Florio ran for governor. And my landlord was very active in Florio's congressional campaign, although in fact he had very little to do with his gubernatorial campaign. Rumor had it that if Florio got elected, I'd be the next adjutant general, which is not a job I want. Two stars. I used to have the rank, but if you want to give me two stars, make me division commander. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, so that in order to ensure that I wasn't eligible, the then current National Guard Adjutant General said that he was going to, at that time I was a brigade commander, and said they were going to reassign me to some place which called for a rank lower than mine, and I would be forced out.
Hmm.
So he said, you can exit gracefully. So I did.
So, sounds like
politics. What you find in the National Guard is not only internal politics, but real-life politics. Because I knew one battalion commander who was well-connected politically. He was not a very good battalion commander. And one of the years we went to Fort Drum, the 24th Infantry Division provided the officers who were to evaluate what we were doing in our training. And the division commander of the 24th at that time was General Schwarzkopf. And I remember he found that in that guy's, I'm mentioning his battalion, that some troops hadn't been fed. They'd been left out in an outpost, a guard post, and not fed. And he came storming into our CP and threw his helmet around and said the man should be relieved on the spot. Now, one of the things you don't do in the National Guard is relieve people on the spot who have political connections. So, again, real politics and National Guard politics both play.
Right. So the whole time you were in the National Guard, you were still practicing law. And
yes.
How long did you stay with that? That first firm out of Atlantic City?
I want to say 3 years. I think I left them in 73.
And is that when you went out on your own?
No, then I went to, I got an offer of a substantial increase in salary, and I took it. But the firm I went to, they had recently taken over. They did personal injury work, too, defense work. They had taken over representation of Allstate, which put a real strain on their assets. So they did hire some new lawyers. to fill the hole until they got organized on that. And then in 75, I said, I'm going to take a chance. And the guy who was my battalion commander had this building in Newfield. He offered me $135 a month furnished. Couldn't beat that with a stick.
So the office that you're sitting in now, you've been there since 1975?
Correct. Now I own the building.
Wow. And you have been on your own since 1975?
Yep.
Wow. That's impressive. I mean, now you right now, you don't have a secretary right now, do you?
Nope.
Did you ever at any point in time?
For a brief period of time, I had my landlord's sister-in-law, and there was a falling out in his family, and so he told her to go, never darken his door again. So I had no secretary.
You
know, one of the most valuable courses I ever took was in junior high when I took personal typing. And I found out that I could type faster than half the people who worked for me when I was in the Army. Because I spent most of my time in the Army as the adjutant, S1 as they call it, because that's where they like to put people who have legal training. And one of the things I got to do was when we had a court-martial, I got to pick who's going to be the prosecutor, who's going to be the defense attorney, and then the brigade would task a battalion, another battalion, to provide the actual members of the court-martial. So, I mean, if I had been a nasty person, I could really have put the irons to some of these people by giving them a lousy defense attorney or ensuring they got nothing but the best.
But you were never in the JAG.
No. Mm-hmm. No, if I wanted to be in the JAG, I would have had to give them 4 years. And I thought, I really want to be in private practice someday, and I don't want to give them 4 years to do that. So 3 years, I was good enough, and I left.
So when you go into practice in 1975, what type of law? I mean, it sounds like you've been primarily handling either personal injury or insurance defense. Is that right up until that point?
Yeah. I did a little bit of everything that came down. Mm-hmm.
As all good soul practitioners have to do.
Yeah, and I did some divorces, which I find very off-putting. Mm-hmm. I'm really not into fighting over pots and pans. Mm-hmm. And some of the antics, I mean, it wasn't on my watch. The first firm I worked for, they inherited a guy he and his spouse did the classic nonsense. Whoever was off at work, the other one would pull up the van and offload property from the house, the former marital residence. And I mean, it was back and forth they were doing this. And I said, this is not my idea of an interesting thing to do. So, I think it was in 75, it may have been early in 76, that I applied to the public defender's office in Cumberland County, and they asked me would I be willing to go to Cape May, because at that time Cumberland ran Cape May.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, sure.
And you mean doing pool work?
I beg your pardon?
Do you mean doing pool work, or do you mean
okay, pool work.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's when you basically started doing criminal defense, because you've become known as a formidable criminal defense attorney in Cape May, Cumberland, Atlantic counties.
Right.
And you've been doing it, and you still are practicing criminal defense and doing pool work in those counties.
Not Cumberland
anymore. Okay.
Yeah. There was a period of time one of the staff attorneys went out and made a baby. So they needed somebody to be what they call a per diem, temporary help.
Mm-hmm.
And I took that job, and I said, I really can't handle Cumberland County.
Mm-hmm.
Atlantic's just up the road, relatively speaking. And so I stopped doing Cumberland work.
And that was just recently, because I remember that.
No. I've done that twice.
Okay.
this I'm talking about the first time, that's what when I stopped doing Cumberland, because in the interim, they put in more traffic lights. And if I, what used to take me a little more than an hour, now took about a good hour and a half.
To get up to Bridgeton?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but talk to me a little bit. You know, I'm originally from Bridgeton, and actually, I have a podcast called The Bridgeton Beacon, where I interview folks in the Bridgeton, South Jersey area. So I think actually this interview will get placed on two separate podcasts. So I'm interested just to talk for a couple minutes about Cumberland County courts and what it was like back when you started doing criminal defense work in the 70s and 80s, because I did a little search through the Bridgeton Evening News, and there were just so many articles of matters where you are named in articles for cases that you handled up there. So I'm curious what the court was like back then, in Cumberland specifically.
We had a couple, there's one judge. Well, when I was in high school, I took Latin because somebody told me that Latin would be helpful if you were going to go into the law. So I did 3.5 years of Latin because in my school district, the ninth grade, we had a junior high school, senior high system. And at 10th grade was when you moved to the senior high. But in ninth grade, they had a half semester, a half year Latin course. So that's why it's 3.5 years. And I ran to one judge, Judge Miller, who actually did know some of the more obscure Latin terms that were used in the law. But I found out quickly, it didn't matter. Aside from habeas corpus, that's the only Latin I've ever had to make any use of. Well, I also know de minimis non curat lex. The law doesn't trouble itself with trifles.
That's true. That's true. But you handled a number of trials.
Yeah, there was a time, 1 year, when I did more trials than the staff attorney.
I believe it. How many trials do you think you've done? Do you have any idea in your whole entire career, 58 career, how many trials you've had?
I would guess over 100. I have it written down someplace, just one loss and what have you, just for my own amusement.
Wait, one loss in all those years?
I say no. One loss.
Got one.
In my opinion, when the defense attorney wins, means somebody made a mistake, because the prosecutor should not be bringing cases that are losers. You just shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
So either the prosecutor, when it came time to plea negotiate, made an outrageous demand, or sometimes you have clients who just don't see the life. Mm-hmm. Don't take you. But so, I mean, I would guess that realistically, I've won about a third of the cases I've been in on.
Mm-hmm. Did you never consider becoming a prosecutor? Sometimes
you see
people with a military background kind of move towards or become attracted to doing prosecution.
No, I had literally no interest in that. And the other thing I had no interest in was being a judge. I never thought I had all the answers, and judges have to have all the answers if you're doing your job right.
Mm-hmm.
One of the guys who was a judge who just always impressed me was Steve Kleiner. He was, at the time he was appointed, he was, I believe, the youngest judge in the state of New Jersey. And one of the things he could do is he could charge a jury without using notes, which impresses me.
Cumberland County Superior Court.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he could, he'd just sit up there and talk to them. And he'd talk in very clear English. I said, one time I said to him, I think I'm going to appeal your case, because if Supreme Court wanted that much clarity, in your charges, they'd have written it that way. I mean, he was good at it, really good at it.
Well, so, you know, you have been a practicing attorney for what, just under 60 years, 58 years by my math. And I'm really curious. There's a couple things. First, just how the practice, not just of criminal law, but the practice of law in general has changed. I know it's changed a lot, but big picture, how has it changed in your opinion? For the good, for the bad?
Sideways. I mean, the changes, oddly enough, the change, to talk to a layman would probably think that these are the most significant changes. They occurred at points in my career where it really didn't make that big a difference. For example, you used to have voir dire, which was individual lawyer got to question each individual juror, determine whether they had any prejudices or otherwise. And then they abolished it and went to the system they have now, where the judge has a list of approved questions to ask, and he reads, you know, everybody gets a little piece of paper with those questions on them, and we go through that. So there's rarely any direct input from the attorneys in terms of questioning a juror. Well, when they abolished that, just before I tried, not just before, but a couple of months before I tried my first case, so I never experienced voir dire. Therefore, the change didn't affect me. Similarly, I wasn't practicing very long when they changed the rules. We used to practice under what they call revised rules. And you may see some citations to RR.
Mm-hmm.
They changed to the present rules. I wasn't really settled in with the revised rules as far as that goes, so it was not a big transition for me. And the third thing, which one would think would be chaotic, would be the shift, the adoption of Title IIc, the criminal code.
Mm-hmm.
Used to be all criminal laws were under 2A.
Yeah.
Well, when I started doing the criminal work, again, I hadn't been practicing doing criminal work for all that long when they went to 2C. So, you know, I hadn't mastered 2A by any means, and how I got a new system, I learned it from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
So those changes have all gone on. As far as I was concerned, didn't have much impact on me. I'll tell you one change that does have an impact on me, because I'm not a morning person. Court started at 10 o'clock.
Really?
When I first started out. Yeah.
Well, they probably, yeah, did they go a lot later?
I beg your pardon?
Did they end a lot later?
No, 4:30.
Yeah. Okay.
So then somebody decided we should be able to do at least an hour more. You know, the beauty part about, well, when I first started out, the Atlantic County Civil Court was in the Guaranty Trust Building, North Carolina and Atlantic Avenue, a bank building, and they were on the seventh floor. Mm-hmm. Of course, now they have a brand new building, mm-hmm. catty corner from where they were. Where it's just nothing but civil, you know, got all your divorces and all the personal right. injury cases there, and of course the criminal course where it is. But that's in a new courthouse.
Mm-hmm.
But the rise paperwork, it's one of the reasons why I don't enjoy doing personal injury work, because it's a paper war as far as I'm concerned. But the paperwork, as far as, I mean, a plea form used to be a couple of pages long. Now, minimum is 6 pages.
Right.
And if you got some of a weird situation, if it's a no early release act case, you got to fill out a form for that. If it's a sex case, you got to fill out a couple of forms for that.
Mm-hmm.
This, that. And it even reached the point, as you're aware, where you've got signed forms you have to sign that say you understand your appeal rights. And I can tell you, my experience was a lot of defendants, as soon as they heard the judge pronounce the sentence, which presumably was in accordance with the plea agreement, and they were satisfied they got what they thought they were going to get, they start talking to their lawyer. They're not paying attention to anything else the judge is saying, which did include telling them about your right to appeal. And I suspect what happened is somebody appealed to the appellate division and said, nobody told me I had a right to it.
Right.
So until now they have the form you have to fill out.
Right.
So, I mean, it's just, there's a lot of papers that have been generated by just over the years. Mm-hmm. And they've become more than a nuisance than anything else. I mean, you know, if you go through the standard plea form, a lot of the questions they have on there don't really apply to your case. One of the things that bothers me is that you've got two lines, one of which talks about if you're on probation, you want to move out of state, you have to query your probation officer, which I can understand, but it has a separate entry for sex cases. But they don't have an NA block. You don't have a mm-hmm. sex case. What do you fill in?
Right.
Yeah.
I'm impressed. I mean, with all of the electronic discovery now, for the 5 or so years that I was in private practice, the amount of time that it took to request discovery, get discovery, download discovery, then copy that electronic discovery to give a copy to the client. I don't know how you do it without any kind of administrative help. I mean, that in and of itself is a full-time job plus. You know, I like trees just like everybody else, but I really liked when you were able to just have the paper discovery. And same with, you know, interviews. I mean, you used to be able to get them on discs, and that was, you know, when I was a prosecutor, we would copy discs, and at least then you could pop them in and listen to them. Now, you have all these criminal cases, Steve, in all these different counties, and you've got to download and somehow be able to view, you know, body-worn camera footage, which never works half the time, and then get copies of that to your client. I mean, how in the world do you do it?
Long hours.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, on a typical night, if I get home before 8, that's good.
And I mean, you're spending.
And I work. Yeah. I work 5, 6 days a week, Monday through Saturday, doing something.
I would imagine. Correct me if I'm wrong. That you must enjoy it. I mean, you've been, you know,
it's always. Yeah, I mean, the thing about criminal cases, problem solving, and then, you know, if you can find the hole that you need, you know, I don't call it a loophole, but there's some problem with the discovery that you, or in the discovery which reveals that there's a problem with the case, you can do some interesting things. Mm-hmm. Some cases I have are stone losers. The biggest problem is convincing the client that, well, I just had a guy who outfoxed himself. He had a plea offer which I recommended he seriously take because his actual exposure is humongous. And he refused, and so we just tried his violations of probation. And the prosecutor basically is asking for 12 years, 5 years on one and 7 on the other, which is a second-degree crime. Whether he gets it or not, I don't know, but my client's plea offer was originally 42 months. So, and we haven't even gotten to the consequences of the case itself, because that offer is off the table. Mm-hmm. He just outfoxed himself. One of the things that is good is if you can convince the client to what's really in his best interest, not what the boys wearing orange jumpsuits who are practicing law in the jail tell him.
Right, right. Well, I mean, do you think the advent of criminal justice reform and the elimination of cash bail has been a good thing or not a good thing?
I would say, by and large, it is a good thing. Mm-hmm. Although I didn't find that when you're talking 10% that you have to lay down on all the cash bails to get a bail bondsman, it's not that onerous. And there are people who are locked up who are really bit players in a rather large scheme of some sort. You know, one of those ones with you have 30 or 40 defendants listed. And, you know, your guy, I got one where the original discovery I got was basically bank records. I didn't even mention my client's name. And that's, I want to say, over 500 pages of stuff I had to print. You talk about running this stuff off. Well, I have, not only have to print, I have to look through it to see if it mentions his name, and all of it is bank records.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is your most memorable trial?
Oh, I had one which was alleged sexual contact. The girl claimed that it was her grandfather who was touching her where he shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. But she also changed her story several times and testified that while all this was supposedly going on, that their place down at the shore, her parents were right outside the door, and she never contacted them. Mm-hmm. So I won that one, and that really surprised me, because my experience is that people who get on those kinds of cases, the jurors, often want to send a message. I had another case where this guy was, again, a sex case. And I'm still convinced that there were jurors who had absolutely strong bias against those kinds of offenses. And we're just waiting, because it's one of the few cases that I lost that I couldn't figure out why. And I think it has to be the nature of the allegations. And he said, oh, somebody's guilty of this. Let's punish them all.
Mm-hmm. Well, those cases are very hard. I handled them as a prosecutor and also as a defense attorney, and they're very, very difficult. But you know, we had a trial together. I don't know if you remember it or not, but you beat me. It was my first.
Can I pay money?
Yeah. It was my first jury trial in New Jersey. And it was counterfeit $20 bill case. And you really, I was very young. As I said, it was my first jury trial. But you have a way with jurors to just speak to them like we're speaking right now. And you really connect with jurors. And I guess that's why you've had 100 trials and been so successful.
I remember that case vividly, and you did a heck of a job with not much to work with.
Well, you said if a prosecutor loses a case, then something must have gone wrong. But I think sometimes juries nullify if they think that, you know, we meaning prosecutors, have kind of wasted their time. So,
you know, that was his excuse was semi plausible.
Right.
I mean, you always have that problem with counterfeit money, was to, you know, whether the guy really knew it was counterfeit,
right,
and was passing it off that way, or as this guy claimed, where he just got it in change for something and he pulled it out and paid his gas bill with that gasoline bill.
I don't think your closing argument was very long, but it was succinct and to the point.
I'm not good at long, drawn-out arguments. I can't comprehend what a person can talk about. I mean, because one of the things is every case has two or three key items, and either they go your way or they go the prosecutor's way. But the rest of it is meaningless.
Yeah.
I mean, if you sit there and try and nitpick every little piece of issue, jurors' eyes glaze over.
Mm-hmm. Good advice for those that are listening. I want to talk to you for a couple minutes about, you know, we've talked about the practice of law, but I want to talk to you about the business of the practice of law. And I think that's really hard for many sole practitioners. And, you know, just being able to manage the business side of it. I mean, Any advice for any young lawyers?
I'm not good at that at all.
And that's the thing. A lot of attorneys are very, very good attorneys, but they're really not great business people. And then on the other hand, you have other attorneys that are good business people, but really probably shouldn't be in the courtroom. So to have both of them together, and you must be a good business person. You've been doing it for almost 60 years. So I just didn't know if you had any comments about that.
The thing is, I don't do the kinds of things. I've never felt comfortable doing the kinds of things that bring in a lot of the high-priced businesses, big cases. I mean, I don't join the local clubs. I'm not a Rotarian, or I don't mean to deprecate any of them, but a lot of people join so they can make a contact there to get business.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not involved in that. What few organizations I participate in are things that I do because I want to do them for whatever reason. I mean, I have subscription. One of the things that's always fascinating me is the Roman Army.
Mm-hmm.
And so I subscribe to the Journal of Roman Studies, which a good friend of mine used to call the Pedants to Light. But it's an annual thing that just discusses various factors in Roman history, some of which is interesting to me, some of which I don't really care about. The potsherd they found in some dig doesn't impress me. But point is that's something I enjoy, Roman military history, so I get what I can about it, and I've got a pile of books.
And you have always been a history buff. I remember speaking to you years ago about history and the importance of history.
I followed it through with I got interested in my family genealogy. And it's interesting that the internet has been very helpful. You know, when I first started out doing that stuff, after my father died, which is 1977, I picked up all his notes, and he had a lot of material from various sources, but he didn't have a computer. They were just starting to come in with these computer genealogical programs. So I started putting the stuff up on there, and suddenly it made a pattern. I could see who was related to who, and piece together the family. So there has been one history that's now written by a guy, a lawyer, Syracuse lawyer, that described the first early generations of my family. And I think I've found enough evidence to correct and change that in terms of who was related to who and how. So I mean, that's the same. It's basically the same thing. My family history is an interest just as it is. I had ancestors that fought in the Revolution. Mm-hmm. They lived in the town of Stillwater, New York. Stillwater, New York is just a fairly not to us lazy car-ridden people. It's a fair walk, but it is an easy walk from Stillwater to the Saratoga battlefield. And he participated in that.
Wow.
Well, they did. He was a father and his two sons. My direct ancestor was 16 years old. And it was sort of interesting because you dig into stuff, you find out what happened is they'd go out there in the daytime, and when night fell, they'd go back home.
Wow.
Show up the next day. Here I am. Warfare was a lot. And I did have one group of my family moved to Louisiana. And one of them served in some Louisiana regiment in the Civil War. And he published a book. And he would go home for weeks on end. Nobody seemed to care.
Wow.
So
it's a little different.
Those were little sidelights, and I don't know that most people who even do research in my family are aware of that.
Well, in the advent of Ancestry.com or 23andMe, DNA testing, I think, has helped a lot of people find people in their family and learn more about the history. I actually subscribed recently to genealogybank.com, and you can access newspapers from all over the country. And it's been really interesting to me. I don't know if you've ever checked that out, but very, very interesting. Speaking of Roman army and your interest in military history, I came across an article, gosh, I want to think it's from like the mid-80s, where you and a group of other gentlemen in the Northfield area were part of a club that did war games.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
I remember that, yeah. I bought one of these games, Avalon Hill games, Tactics 2. I couldn't figure out how to play it. And then while I was in the Army, one of my friends, who actually was a true unicorn, he was a Harvard ROTC graduate. It's almost as a contradiction in terms. But he was a war gamer, and he got me started. This guy ended up working for the CIA.
Oh, wow.
Interesting fellow.
Wow.
And unfortunately, he died relatively young. I would say he was in his 40s, and came home one night and went up to lie down, just take a nap, never woke up.
Well, I think that the importance of history can't be overstated for a lot of reasons. And, it's neat to be able to speak with you today about, the history of the practice of law in the South Jersey area for the last almost 60 years. And that's why I think it's so fun to have this conversation with you. I'm sure we could speak all day about things that have happened over the years and how that's led to changes in the system.
As I said, I'm convinced that it was just because of that we have the appeal rights form you have to fill out, because somebody whined and said he didn't know he had to. He had a right to take any appeal until much later, and he was out of time, and da-da-da-da-da. And then, the myriad of papers when you put through a plea, depending upon the nature of the case, obviously reflect some problem that somebody conjured up. They decided they were going to solve with making you fill out another form. Go ahead.
I'm sure it's because they have had individuals who appeal their pleas, so they want to make sure that it's knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, and it's a contract, right? So that's why it's recorded and all of that. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the amount of forms that have to be filled out for putting a case on the trial list.
I'll tell you what, one of the changes I've noticed over the years, when I first started out, a lot of the defendants did what I like to call the code of the West, which was basically if they got caught and there were a couple other co-defendants and they're the ones responsible for whatever went on, I found that most of my clients would step up and say, yeah, I did it, and get their other people off the hook. Mm-hmm. But with the advent of the drug cases, that stopped. It's a different clientele. And in fact, obviously, as you were well aware, drugs have an involvement in a lot of different cases. The man that commits a burglary, he's committing a burglary because he needs to sell some of the stuff he's going to grab so he can buy his next fix. Right. And I think that itself has changed a lot of what the practice of law is about. Because, on the other hand, in the same vein, thank God for drug court. I think that's one of the better programs that seems to work. I had an experience. I go to Shore Memorial for cardiac maintenance, and I ran into this guy. I didn't recognize him. He said, "Oh, you're Mr. Patrick." I said, "Yeah." He said, "You saved my life." And he's working there. He's wearing one of the maintenance uniforms. And he told me, "Yeah, he'd gotten into drug court." did it successfully, and now he's gainfully employed. And I felt really pleased.
Yeah.
That's when you really are helping somebody else.
Right. I mean, yeah, you think about if you can do that, and I'm sure you've done that for many, many people, but that makes it all worth it. That makes those late nights all worth it when someone yep. says that to you, because that's what it's yep. all about. I mean, you said at the beginning of this conversation that you knew early on you wanted to handle criminal law, and you have. So what advice
Absolutely
would you
right.
give to young lawyers? There's a lot of young lawyers out there. I mean,
yeah, there's too many.
Well, I think sometimes that lawyers that haven't tried cases tend to, whether you're talking about a prosecutor or a defense attorney, they often tend to overvalue their position. So losing is sometimes the best way to learn.
Yeah.
Would you do it all over again?
I would, although I must tell you, I didn't encourage my children to go into law.
You did or you did not?
I did not. I did mm-hmm. not. Mm-hmm. So I have no lawyers following me. My father had gone to law school. He went back in the old days. It was not uncommon for people to go to law school at night.
Oh, wow.
So he went to what was then, I mean, even then it was Mercer Beasley School of Law, or it might have been Newark Law School. It's now Rutgers, Newark. But he got his LLB. Mm-hmm. But by that time, he was married and had a child, and he couldn't. In those days, you had to do, I think, 9 months clerkship mm-hmm. in some law firm. Not necessarily like a judge's law clerk, but you work at the law firm for 9 months, and what they got paid just didn't work for my father, so he never practiced.
Oh, wow.
I may have been part of it. He never really encouraged me either way. I mean, he didn't discourage me either, but it wasn't a matter of he's sitting there saying, gee, son, I'd like you to be a lawyer. That'd be a good thing for you. Do what I couldn't do.
Right.
There's none of that. But
right.
So I have his diploma.
Well, there's a lot of sacrifices that you have to make when you're an attorney. I mean, you had a family, you had, you know, children, and you worked long hours, and, you know, you...
Yeah, every once in a while, I'd come home and my wife had to say, who are you?
Yeah. Your wife was a longtime English teacher at Holy Spirit, right?
Absolutely right.
Yeah. I think they still talk about her over there.
Well, it's interesting. One of the deputy attorney generals came up to me the other day and asked me if I was related to somebody who taught at Holy Spirit. And I said, yeah. She was my wife, and she was very, very fulsome in her praise, which I found very flattering, because I always thought my wife was a good teacher, but, you know, you never know how the students perceive her.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully she didn't get too mad at you about your spelling.
She learned how to read my handwriting, more to the point.
I've seen your handwriting. You type up a lot of your plea forms, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
I remember that.
I try to avoid forcing people to read my writing.
So you put those plea forms right in the typewriter? You still
do
that?
I have a typewriter. Yeah.
Wow.
I have an electric typewriter here, and I also have my great aunt's manual typewriter.
Oh, neat. I have a couple typewriters, yeah, but I just collect them. I don't use them.
Well, you know, the thing of now, of course, you can upload forms. They have them all online.
Right.
Most of the standard forms, their index system is terrible,
mm-hmm.
so it's a matter of chance when you can stumble on the forms you need. But
well, hopefully the AOC is listening. They can improve that.
I don't think they listen to anybody. They do what they want to do, and if you don't like it, doesn't matter. Do it.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time today to speak with me.
Not a problem.
And I should have started with this, but sincerely, thank you for your service to the country, and thank you for your service to all of the citizens of South Jersey that you have represented.
As I point out to a lot of people, in the 3 years I was in Germany, no Warsaw Pact troops came across the border. So I'm taking credit for that.
As you should. As you well should. All right, sir. Thank you very, very much for today. I'm sorry we had a little bit of trouble there in the beginning, but I'm glad we pushed through and got this done.
Okay. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, if you want, if you want to come back, we can try it again.
Well, if you want me, if anybody's foolish enough to want to hear me rattle on, that's fine.
I think most people are very happy to hear you speak, and I told a couple people that I was going to be interviewing you today, and many people said they were very excited to hear this. So, thank you again.
Well, they're kidding you. They're saying it because they're polite.
No, I don't think so. These aren't polite people. No. All right. Have a great afternoon, and let's stay in touch. And I'm glad we ran into each other so we could set this up.
Yeah, I miss working with you. I really do. I'm sorry. Obviously you got to go where you got to go. But, I was one thing I didn't comment on, although there are a lot more women in the profession, they all seem to have taken governmental jobs. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the majority of the attorneys in the Cape May prosecutor's office are female.
They are.
And I'm mm-hmm. glad to see women in the biz, but... At the same time, I wish there were more defense people.
It's a hard practice.
Yeah, well, I can understand that. It's just a phenomenon that I'm not completely satisfied myself. I understand about why so many women go to government jobs. Prosecutor, deputy attorney general, and things like that. Because...
It's probably the hours.
You may be right. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. My notion is, I'll do whatever it takes. And there are some. You're right. There's some discovery. I've got one like a case I told you where I couldn't find my client's name. They've mm-hmm. uploaded some 8,000 more pages worth of stuff that I've got to pull down.
Oh my goodness!
And weed through to find out something. Mentions her name.
You have to try to search.
It was a little scam. Yeah. They opened up bogus bank accounts. They put a little bit of money in there, and then they would overdraw the account.
All right. Yeah, I've had a few cases like that in my history.
Yeah, I'm sure you have.
Follow the money, Steve.
Cherchez l'argent.
All right. Well, thank you again. And let's talk again soon.
Anytime.
All right. Have a good afternoon.
Talk to you later.
All right.